I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the LRB podcast. If you subscribe to the LRB, you can get the first 12 issues for just £12. To find out more, go to lrb.me/listen. That's lrb.me/listen.
Hello, and welcome to the London Review of Books podcast. My name is Thomas Jones, and today I'm talking to John Lanchester, who's written a piece in the current issue of the LRB about Georges Simenon and his 75 Maigret novels, which Penguin have just finished reissuing in new translations. Hello, John.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me. And I thought we could begin where you begin your piece, with Simenon's colossal output, as you put it, and that nobody knows how many books he actually wrote, though it was probably more than 400, which is fewer than Barbara Cartland, but still puts the rest of us to shame.
No, he didn't half crack on, that's true. Yes, he started as a young man in Liège, his hometown in Belgium, and he got a job as a reporter on a local paper. I think he was not quite 16, which is properly strange. It's like something out of a high concept kids TV show, you know, Georges Simenon, boy reporter. And very early on latched onto the idea of making money through writing. And so he started doing it. I think his first book he began writing when he was 18, came out when he was 19. He started writing every sort of potboiler, thrillers, romances, sort of semi-porn, westerns, things like that. At an absolutely astounding rate of productivity. And he would write, his daily target was 80 pages a day, typewritten. And even on the assumption that a page is sort of, I mean, a short page would be 150 words, and it could well have been more, I don't think we know, but it's 10,000 words a day. And he did that every single day. And then he'd write 80 pages, and then he'd go and be sick just from the physical and mental exertion and the strain. And then in the afternoon, I mean, that was in the morning. And then he'd kind of recover and, you know, do a bit of light reading and pottering about. And then the next day he'd do it the same again, over and over and over for about 7 years. And in that period, he, as you mentioned, we don't know exactly how many because he forgot. And he had multiple pseudonyms. The main one being Georges Sim, S-A-M, which was how he was known. When he began writing the Simenon novels, people thought that Simenon was a pseudonym because Georges Sim was so well known. But he seems to have written something like 150 or more books in this sort of 7 year burst. It sort of makes you feel peculiar even to think about what that must have been like.
Yeah, and that was in Belgium in the 1920s.
Well, mainly Belgium. And then he moved to Paris, I think basically as soon as he could afford to. I've forgotten the exact date. And cut quite a figure in Paris. You know, Georges Sim was famous. And then in, let me remind myself of the date.
It's 1930, the first Maigret.
That's right. The first ones came out. I think he sort of set out on the project when he was about 25 and 28. He decided he'd learnt enough because it seemed that the kind of hack writing also seemed to have had a conscious element of learning how to do it, learning his craft. And he set out to write what he called semi-literary novels. In other words, books that were sort of in pitch at the intelligent general reader, but had quite a strong genre element. And Maigret pops up first in a short story, I think from 28, that might be wrong. And he sort of realised that Maigret was the way to do it, the way to, you know, the character who would let him write these books that he'd always been wanting to write. And interestingly, for someone who was quite reclusive in later life, you know, he launched, it was a big party. They published, I can't remember how many, but they published a whole bunch of them in one go and had a huge fancy party to launch it. And as I say, that, you know, part of it was getting across the point that Georges Simenon was actually a person, not the pseudonym. And he, you know, he was living quite a sort of big life at that point. He had an affair with Josephine Baker, slightly unlikelily, who was, you know, arguably the most famous woman in Paris at that point. Famous exotic dancer, you know, he would appear in this costume completely naked apart from a dress made of bananas. And he said of her that she has the most famous bottom in the world. And it's the most famous because it is the only bottom that laughs. I think we may never know what that means. And so, you know, he was really quite a sort of expansive, colourful, lively figure in Paris in the late 20s, and then launched the Maigret novels, I think four or five of them in one go, brought out from Fayard, I think it was, with this huge party. And then, you know, kept up. I think he always wrote as quickly, but he didn't write quite as long hours, if you see what I mean.
And it wasn't every day by that point, was it? The way you describe it, that he would, this very brilliant analogy of yours, as if he went into a room and went into a different place where Maigret was, and that's where he wrote the novels very intensively over the period of a week. So he wasn't writing every single day as he had been in his apprentice period.
He'd write them in these extraordinary bursts. I was trying to imagine how it must have been for Simenon, and the sort of room thing is, I suspect, what it must have been like, that sort of Maigret was in a place in his head. And he would feel a Maigret coming on, almost like an illness, and would literally go to his doctor for a checkup to see if he was physically well enough to write a book. And he would sort of take notes. He would often know the characters' backstories in tremendous detail. And then the actual process of writing was like a sort of siege. He would just disappear into the room, be brought his meals. I think he'd basically come out to go to the loo and to sleep, and that was it. And they were all written within about 12 days, a fortnight, 7 to 10 days of writing, and then 2-3 days revision. And, you know, bingo, there it was, a book of, they're usually between sort of 30,000-35,000 words. And, you know, in the first year of them, the first year they came out, which is 1931, I think he published 10. And then 7 more in the next year. And I think he'd written some of them in 29. He had a sort of run-up. But it's still, I think, for books that, you know, the most disparaging thing you could say about them is that they aren't terrible. And if you really like them, as I do, you'd say they're really good. You know, I think it's a pretty unmatched rate of productivity, 17 of them in 2 years.
And so consistent, as you say, as well.
They are very consistent. And I do think that on some level that is linked to the way he wrote them, that they... That's where the idea of this sort of room image came to me, that it's as if he was sort of re-encountering Maigret. And so they are, you know, there aren't ones that are outright howlers that you just can't get through. I mean, I'm a huge Agatha Christie fan, but there are quite a few, you know, absolutely rank Christie novels, quite often ones where she's sort of preoccupied by international plots and conspiracies, that, you know, even as a proper fan, it's a real struggle. And Simenon's not like that, not in the Maigret books anyway.
You're comparing his writing to a fever seems to be a much better analogy than perhaps a more obvious and quite commonly made one, which is that it was about the urge to write and his sex drive being similar. But he showed a lot more control in his writing than he did in his sex life, didn't he?
Yeah, there was a sort of madness to his sex drive. We should say we don't know how much of it's true. There was this famous thing where he claimed to have slept with is a euphemism there, 10,000 women, and his strange second wife, Denise, said it was complete rubbish. It was, you know, 1,500 at most.
Only 1,200.
Yeah. So even on her numbers, it was pretty compulsive. But yeah, I mean, he claimed that he needed sex 2 or 3 times a day. And there was obviously in him a kind of need, a hunger, an unfillable lack connected with sex or affection. Or, it's, as you say, it's sometimes described as appetite, but I'm not sure it is. I think there's something more hysterical about it. It's sort of not like hunger. I don't know. It's like an unscratchable itch that, you know, was completely how his sexuality worked. I mean, one of the odd things about Josephine Baker is that seems to be one of the only times he actually had an affair. And he fled. He actually went away. He went traveling to get away from her. because he had this compulsive sex drive, but he didn't actually like having affairs. His preferred thing was, you know, having quickie sex with a chambermaid or going to brothels. So it's one of the many respects in which, you know, he was a properly odd person, Simenon. He really was sort of driven, compulsive, as I say, a school of the late Michael Neave is a great friend of the LRB for many years. I don't think he ever wrote about it, but I remember he used to talk very funnily about studies in male hysteria, about sort of male hysteria being a neglected topic. And I think Simenon was one of the great male hysterics.
And of course, when he was in his one of his writing periods in that week, 10 days that he was writing, he wasn't having sex two or three times a day. That he was writing instead. And he'd gone into sort of the Maigret world where, and Maigret is very different, doesn't he? He's a heavy drinker and he likes eating. But
yeah, and Maigret is immensely uxorious. That's one of the things through all the books, that Madame Maigret is a very important character. And she very much grounds the books in a kind of domestic daily reality. She's always doing this, cooking these very Franco-French kind of classic bourgeois cooking meals. And they're always particularised and characterised. It's never, you know, Maigret had supper. It's always, you know, vichyssoise followed by, you know, sole à la meunière, followed by a kind of cherry sorbet. And the drinks are always, I mean, that's one of the things I like about them, is incredibly particular. You know, his drinking's really funny because he often does that engaging thing of, you know, starting at breakfast. He's having a cognac or a Calvados or something and just keeps going all day, which Simenon, again, wasn't like. But there is in the books, there's clearly a whole set of, you know, drives and appetites being sublimated, because the sex is often getting the characters in trouble, but there's no sex in Maigret's life. Instead, what there is, you know, good, solid bourgeois cooking.
Yeah, and at the beginning of Maigret and the Grand Banks, as the new translation's called, that he gets a letter from a friend in Brittany saying, can you come and help this sailor who's been accused of murder? And he says to Madame Maigret, is it all right if we don't go to Alsace for our summer holidays this year, but go to Brittany instead? And she's a bit disappointed because she likes going home to Alsace and making jam and everything. But she grudgingly agrees and takes her crocheting with her to pass the time in Brittany.
And the other thing about Alsace is the slow gin. Her sister makes slow gin, and Maigret often, you know, is a big fan of it. And there's the thing in one of the strange books, Maigret's Memoirs, which is the book that pretends to be by Maigret, talking about his own life, in which he talks about meeting Simenon, tells the story of his marriage, things like that. And he actually specifically mentions the slow gin there, that in one of the novels, Simenon had changed it to someone else, and, you know, he welcomes the opportunity to put the record straight. You know, I mean, it's really interesting how charged that domestic and culinary side of the books are. And I think it's because of that thing of it's a physical reality, it's a psychological reality, it's a sort of ordinariness that grounds the books and makes them, I was going to say real, but that's wrong, because the psychology and the crimes are often very real too, but it gives a kind of base note of sort of ordinariness that is very important to the books.
And that presumably most of their readers would identify with more than with the, you know, the canals and the 10th arrondissement and all the rest of it, that they're... To the bourgeois reader of that, it's a way of connecting us, as it were, to the,
yeah, maybe,
you know, the world that we leave when we go to the crime scene.
I think that's probably right. I mean, and it's often a thing you get in fiction that has a sort of a journey towards kind of otherness. In the Maigret novels, it's the criminal world, but it's often a thing in, you know, say in someone like Tolkien, there's this balance between the scary, adventurous, fighty bits and the bits that are comfort and consoling. Jenny Turner read that in a very good piece about Tolkien in the LRB many years ago, that he was very good at kind of comfort and coziness, balancing it with these sort of extreme fantasy elements. And maybe there's a thing in Maigret, as you say, that there's a sort of rhythm between the identifiable familiar and the slightly more strange. And Simenon was equally interested in both. You know, he had a genuine fascination with the things that drove people to commit crime. He found criminals completely relatable. He identified with them. And that's the other kind of reality in his books. You know, the crooks and the baddies and the perpetrators, they're not othered. You know, they're not mysterious and alien and incomprehensible. They're very, very, very similar to Maigret, and by extension to Simenon, and by extension to the reader.
And you mentioned Agatha Christie earlier, and there's an interesting difference between them, that one, I think you quote Maigret's son saying that his father didn't believe in evil. And one of the things that you said in your piece about Agatha Christie a couple of years ago was that she did believe in evil, but she isn't interested in why people do the bad things they do, but she is unflinchingly willing to look directly at the truth that they do them. But that's interesting that Christie believed in evil and wasn't so interested in motive, and Simenon doesn't believe in evil but is interested in motive.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think of them as interesting kind of counterparts to each other in that sense. Yeah, Christie had an almost religious feeling about evil, I think, that it just is, it's a fact, it's a thing in the world. You know, she would go into the why in terms of plot mechanics. She's quite good at that. But she wasn't that bothered about the psychological forces that drove people to do terrible things. She just sort of took it for granted that they did. Whereas, yeah, his whole thing was about that. She's much closer to the dominant strand of, you know, most detective and thriller fiction basically assumes the existence of a force more or less like evil, you know, incomprehensible badness. And Simenon is in a... He's not the only writer who does that. The wonderful Swedish double-act Sjöwall and Walu, who in a strange way are the kind of figures behind the kind of current Scandinavian, I would say moment, but it's more than a decade long, but the kind of upsurge in interest in Scandi crime writing. And they're very unlike all the things they gave birth to, because their thing is sort of pragmatic and realistic and has a sort of sociological underpinning, and they don't believe in evil. And they wrote 10 novels about this detective, Martin Beck. And they are close to Simenon. But yeah, I met John Simenon, I think, in 2013, and we were talking about, I think there were one of the many Wallander series was on at that point, and maybe even...
What on the TV, you mean? There's a Kenneth Branagh one, and there's also a Swedish one.
Yeah, on the telly, or maybe the Kenneth Branagh, and there were Swedish ones as well. And what's the name with the jumper? Remind me of that. Was that The Bridge?
Yeah, The Bridge.
I think that was on at that point too.
No, it's not. It's The Killing. Sorry, The Bridge killing, is the other one. The Killing is, yeah.
That's right. The Bridge is the autistic Swede and the kind of warm-hearted Dane. That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah, The Killing. And so we're talking about them, and he said, and I was just very struck by the way, this complete certainty with he said, but they are the opposite of my father's work. It really landed with me. I thought it was such an interesting observation, as I said, and he then went on to say, because he didn't believe in evil. And I have been thinking about that since. And it is quite a striking thing about what people want from these kinds of stories. It's an interesting corollary. You know, they do like that thing we've just been talking about the kind of rootedness in the real, relatable and daily life. But they also do like this sort of jolt of, you know, incomprehensible badness. And they didn't get it from Simenon.
You're listening to the LRB podcast. The LRB has a new newsletter called Diverted Traffic, which features a different piece from the paper's archive each day. A complete absence of references to plague, pandemics, or quarantine is guaranteed. And the piece will be brought in front of the paywall for 24 hours, so you can share it with anyone you want to. To sign up, go to lrb.me/traffic. That's lrb.me/traffic. Traffic. And if you subscribe to the LRB, you can get the first 12 issues for just £12. To find out more, go to lrb.me/listen. That's lrb.me/listen.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I mean, the other thing that you say about Christie and Marjorie Allingham and Dorothy Sayers and those are the golden age writers of English detective fiction, whose books, as you say, bring comfort, as if they have no smell, and you say they have as much relation to real crime as Alice in Wonderland does. But whereas Simenon is unconsoling.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can read them for comfort in the way that you can read any series for comfort and anything that's set. It's not exactly an irony, but one of the things that's happened is that these are very particular, realistic books set in a carefully described, precise, real-world milieu are now like a fantasy parallel world. You know, Paris in the 30s, long, long gone. You know, the Grand Bank Cafe that you mentioned, an unrecognisable other world. So there is that. There's a kind of coziness to that, I think, that, you know, they wouldn't necessarily have had when they were written. But yeah, Policeman really liked his books and he was very proud of it. Oddly enough, I don't know if he was the commissariat of police, but a senior Paris detective actually had him in when the first couple of them came out. He was invited in to look around the bureau and to just see what, and he got the descriptions of the corridor and things where Maigret works and where suspects are waiting outside before being interrogated. That particular space is very important in the books. His characters spend a lot of time there waiting before going in to be interrogated. And that was taken from real life. And it, as I say, it was because this senior French cop basically said, well, look, if you're going to describe us in your books, you might as well get it right. And he was very, you know, he was proud of the fact that he did. He took trouble on that. And when he refers to, it happened sort of in passing and with quite a light touch, but he refers to forensic textbooks and to forensic principles that the police did use. So I think a lot of the investigations are largely fantastic, you know, when he sort of, you know, waits outside doors for hours and hours and catches a glimpse of the suspect and works out what happened. That's obviously a kind of wish fulfillment element to that. But at the same time, there was a generous sprinkling of real police procedure in it. And the kind of, you know, the English detectives, I mean, I love all those books, by the way, and I do read them from comfort. I multiply reread them. And there's something wonderful about the whole idea of the amateur sleuth. You know, I'm a complete sucker for all that. But, you know, Maigret isn't an amateur sleuth. He's a working policeman.
I mean, another point of comparison in Sherlock Holmes, who, another thing that Holmes and Maigret have in common is that they were finished with, or the writers thought they'd finished with them, that Arthur Conan Doyle went so far as to kill off Holmes and then had to bring him back. And Simenon brought Maigret out of retirement. And the other person your piece made me think of is Tintin, and that Hergé, partly being, they're the same sort of age and being Belgian and the accusations of collaboration during the war. But also when you talked about the sort of Simenon boy reporter, is quite Tintin-like, Tintin-like. And you know, and Hergé came to hate Tintin and used to draw sketches of him being hanged and things like this. So, but did Simenon come to hate Maigret, or was he always...
No, I don't think he did. It's funny you should mention Tintin, because I do think there's an analogy. And they, as you said, they did both get in trouble for the war for similar reasons, for, you know, collaborating, which I think is mainly based on who they wrote for and not having resisted, and, or more cynically, not having, you know, sent the correct signals about resistance. And Patrick Marnham, who wrote, who's one of Simenon's biographers, I think quite convincing on that, that Simenon looked at, he was a friend by correspondence of André Gide. And Gide largely sat out the war and wasn't exactly quietistic, but didn't say much. And Simenon thought that that was an okay role model. But actually, one of the things that happened to Gide was he was massively attacked by, I can't remember why, I think one of his books was attacked by collaborationist pro-Nazi press. And that really helped him, actually, at the end of the war. He was able to produce this as a credential. But Simenon kept on working, kept on publishing, and that was catastrophic for his reputation. So but basically left France because of it, lived in America for almost a decade just to get away from the trail of that, which Hergé didn't do. You know, Hergé was stuck in Belgium with his sort of label hung around his neck. And oddly enough, it had a bigger effect on Hergé's books. You know, the post-war Tintin is much more socially conscious and political in a kind of progressive and thoughtful way, because the politics in Hergé's earlier books, which are kind of terrible, but they're largely and there's an astonishingly pure, clear racism in things like Tintin in the Congo. And the journey that Hergé made, I mean, Hergé's a whole lot of the subject, but there's the most extraordinary arc, both of growth, both in his art and his writing, and also in his politics. You know, he travelled one of the biggest journeys of any 20th century writer and artist, I think. And Simenon didn't really do that. You know, he sort of, as I say, sat the war out, fled to America when he left this bad rep behind him, and then when he restarted writing Maigret's, which is actually still during the war, I think there's no evidence at all to suggest that he hated him, and I think I think in a way, I mean, I don't think he ever said this, but if he sort of missed him, it's almost as if he missed his companionship. And the books that he was writing, the roman d'oeuvre, as they're called, the hard novels, are so hard and so comfortless. And they have this sort of cold, bleak, abandoned, unconsoling, desolate worldview that is there implicitly in the Maigret's, but is softened by Maigret, softened by his impulse to understand and his empathy, and also maybe by some of the domestic stuff I was talking about. And take that away, and you know, they really are staring into the abyss, those roman d'oeuvre. It's almost as if, as I say, Simenon, you know, missed his companion. And the other thing I should also say is that he did live life on a fairly big scale. He always lived in colossal houses and had lots of domestic staff and so on. And, you know, he liked to spend freely. And I think he needed the money, because the roman d'oeuvre are great. But, you know, he's not the first writer to have discovered that the kind of, you know, the most popular and profitable character, you know, from the publishing point of view, that's the one to go with, the one everybody absolutely loves and wants to buy in massive numbers.
So it was partly his readers or the market that brought him back to Maigret.
I think score draw, I'd say, wanting to make Dosh. And I mean, it's a hypothesis about missing him, but the books are warm, you know, when he comes back to Maigret. If you read a couple of the roman d'oeuvre written from that period and then switch back to Maigret, they are, you know, as I say, the worldview is still cold, but there's a sort of emotional warmth and connection in them that is to do with Maigret, I think.
And then he stopped writing really quite suddenly, didn't he, in the early 70s, and about a year after his mother died, which you don't mention, and maybe it's too easy to make too much of that, that somehow his mother died and then he no longer felt the need to write.
Yeah, I mean, he was very, very preoccupied with his relationship with his mother and his mother's sort of coldness and ungivingness. It was one of those sort of classic things where the main thing she could do to have control over him was to withhold approval and praise and all that. And so she did. And he, you know, deeply and passionately minded and never got over it. And, you know, talks about it at great length in his autobiographical writing. I mean, the kind of the wound he describes it is all about his mother. So, yeah, it does look as if there's a connection. But it was quite, you know, he did, you know, it's just an odd thing to say for someone who wrote his last phase of his life, he dictated 22 books about himself. And he'd written a few autobiographies before that. So he'd written something like 25 autobiographical books. But it's a strange thing to say that actually, in a funny way, he didn't particularly live the examined life, Simenon. You know, he was such a slave to his drives and his impulses. And, you know, it's when he moved from one place to another, you know, he sort of moved from Belgium to Paris, moved to the countryside during the war, and then went to America, went back to France, went to Switzerland, stopped writing novels. You know, it's sort of, he would just know he was done with something. You know, he just sort of came to the end of it. And he fitted, the last book was Maigret and Monsieur Charles, and then he just stopped, that's it, stopped writing fiction.
Did he start writing the memoirs before? Because his only daughter, he had several children, he had several sons and one daughter, and she committed suicide in 1978, didn't she? And did he start writing his memoirs after that?
No, he'd begun in, you know, because the writing was so compulsive that he stopped writing fiction and switched to these memoirs. And I'm not going to pretend to have read them because I haven't. They're mostly untranslated. Yeah, the great tragedy of his life in those years was his daughter's suicide. I borrowed a thing Jeremy Harding said to me in the piece. He talked about the autobiographical writings being sinister, which I thought about a lot. And there is something odd about them. They're so flat and so level. And it's the sort of other side, perhaps, of his empathy and his sympathy for people who do these terrible things. There's something slightly sinister about being able to empathize with all motives, if you think about that. I mean, actually, ought we be able to empathize with every single person who does every single terrible thing? There's a absolute, total absence of judgment that, you know, it's almost something dark about it.
Yeah, there's some people it's okay to judge.
Yeah, that he doesn't feel any otherness about anything anyone does, however horrific. And that doesn't hit you in the fiction, but in a funny way, when he turns the spotlight on himself, I suppose it's that thing Graham Greene said, that all writers need a chip of ice in the heart. And Simenon definitely had that.
The memoirs that were translated into English, the LRB sent to Patricia Highsmith to review, so that, you know, he's...
I didn't know that. And what did she say?
Well, not as much as you might hope, actually. It's a slightly disappointing piece. It's a fairly...
Well, she's very good at not saying much, yeah. Actually. That's one of her great strengths.
Yeah, it's a very... I mean, everyone should go and read it, obviously, but it's a fairly sort of straight review of the memoirs and of the, some of which they were published with some things that his daughter had written as well. So it's obviously quite...
Oh, right, I don't know that, but it was not When I Was Old.
Well, I'm not sure how it came about. It's called Intimate Memoirs, including Marie Jo's book.
Oh, no, okay, yeah, no, I do know that one, yeah, yeah. No, When I Was Old is a thing he wrote about... It's a rather wonderful title about a sort of particular year in his life when he suddenly started feeling much older. And he wrote it after he came out of it. Yeah, he sort of felt younger at 60 than he had at 58, which was quite interesting. And it's like that Bob Dylan line about, you know, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Yeah, the other thing I'd been going to ask about earlier is his sense of himself as an outsider with this, which in a literal sense, he went to Paris as a Belgian and... So, that, I mean, he was, in a literal way, an outsider for much of his life.
And I think whatever the wound was that he had from his mum, I think, contributed to that. They weren't affluent. I forgot, the father died when he was young, and I've forgotten what he did. And the war years were extremely hard. He was involved in the black market and involved in this sort of semi-criminal hinterland underworld as a teenager. He was 11 when the war started, and so you saw terrible, desperate things, and really that stayed with him. And I think the dual thing of that sort of, you know, sense of outsideness from his Belgianness, from his sense of not being properly loved by his mother, which is a thing he does go on about, and from, you know, not coming from security and prosperity, and the fact that everything could slip away. I think those things are all very important to him. And the first bunch of Maigrets, for a lot of them, he was an outsider in a very kind of basic sense. He was travelling around on a barge. He had a series of canal boats, and they would change berth every night, and he'd write in the morning. He had servants travelling with him, and who would sleep in a tent. He'd pitch a tent next to the barge. They'd have lunch, and then they'd move on to the next mooring. And so there was he really did like that sense of not rootedness. And a thing I've already mentioned, Patrick Marnham, his biographer, talks about very astutely, I think, that often the view through a window, the world you sit and watch pass by when you're in a cafe, the kind of people around you in a restaurant, public spaces like squares, that's very much the world he describes. It is the view of a traveller. And someone who doesn't live in a place, he doesn't really describe intimate domestic scenes. As Marnham says, he doesn't describe, you know, first communions and family celebrations and weddings and things like that. You know, it really is a sort of, it's like that Henry James said, that a good writer could walk past, I think, the Brigade of Guards barracks and look through the window and get enough material to write a novel about it. And that's Simenon's view. It's that view through the window that he then goes off and writes a novel about.
Or the view from a train as well, that he's very good about on train journeys. And one of the things I noticed in your descriptions of the beginnings, when you talk about how good he is on the weather, and so many of them seem to be at the train journeys.
He absolutely loves that sort of, what Larkin called the poetry of departures. You know, he loved that thing of departures and arrivals and the kind of structured chaos of things like train stations. That's a very sort of Simenon-ish landscape. Funnily enough, the writer who's a bit like that, who I've written about elsewhere, is Lee Child. And his view, travelling around America, travels around everywhere, mainly on Greyhound buses, and he's in diners and cafes and things like that. And there's a weird similarity Child has with Simenon in terms of that, you know, the travelling man's perspective.
And going back to the question of the empathy and the ability to empathise with the people who do the most terrible things, but there are in some of the books, I mean, there are other people who he seems to spend less time thinking about. I mean, for example, in the Grand Banks, and there's Adele, the prostitute, who's been locked in the captain's cabin on this fishing voyage. And two other members of the crew have been going and having sex with her. And the, her point of view, as it were, doesn't, as far as I, if I remember rightly, doesn't, you don't really get any of her point of view in that book. But there is a sort of a horrifying tale of this sort of Bluebeard's prisoner, as it were, trapped in this cabin.
No, you quite often don't get the people's point of view, but you get to empathise with their circumstances. I mean, she doesn't, you don't hear much from her, but it's incredibly vivid, I think, the account of the horror of it. I remember, you know, I don't know, that the sort of thing of this 3-month voyage trapped in a cabin. I thought that was very, very vivid. I suppose it's the predicament that's vivid rather than the kind of account of her character. But I suppose a character being real, for me, it's the sort of same thing as empathy. If you kind of apprehend their human reality through a depiction, that's sort of what empathy is. In fact.
And I suppose my response, he doesn't need to lard it on. If you can get that response from the reader that economically, then that's enough.
Yes, I mean, and they're off. I mean, his accounts of those characters are often quite economical. The kind of people caught up in the circumstances. It's often, as it were, it's the circumstances that make you empathise.
As the bit in the Maigret's remembering his mother's death.
Yeah, I think it's sort of at the heart of it, this thing where his father tries to help out a sort of ruined old drunk of a doctor who'd been disgraced, and his father, who's an estate manager in the Loire, you know, gets him to deliver his second child when his wife's pregnant as an act of, I don't know, is it sort of atonement or forgiveness or acceptance or something? And, you know, it's implied that the doctor messes it up and, you know, his wife and the new baby die. And that's one of the things that makes Maigret very preoccupied with always wanting to empathise and understand this mysterious action that his father had done, this impulse of his father's to empathise. And Maigret sort of, his career as a policeman basically begins there. It's very effectively described, all the more so for there being there's no elaboration. He basically just tells you what happened and lets you work it out.
Yeah, to understand and empathise and not to judge, which Simenon, he explicitly said that was his motto, didn't he, at some point? He said that was his motto as well as Maigret's.
Yeah, and, you know, Maigret is the vehicle for that. And I think it's one of the things that people, you know, keep coming back to the books for, that's rather distinctive about them. As you say, it's not like, you know, as it were, Christie bad, Simenon good, but as you pointed out, it is fascinating that it's so the opposite of a lot of the way things work, because actually the plot and the denouement are quite perfunctory. It might partly be because of that, you know, the writing method we were talking about earlier, that he just was burnt out and knackered, and the last couple of chapters are a bit sketchy and perfunctory quite often when he wraps everything up. But I think it was mainly that he just sort of didn't really care. Once he'd figured out his own satisfaction, why the character had done what they'd done, and sort of led the reader through that, the bit where, you know, the mechanics of the crime get sorted out and explained, he just wasn't particularly interested.
John Lanchester, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You can read John Lanchester's piece on Maigret in the current issue of the LRB, along with The American Virus by Elliot Weinberger, Susan Pedersen on Sheila Delaney, and Nicholas Spice's account of being hospitalised with COVID-19. And you can read John's piece on Agatha Christie and Patricia Highsmith's review of Simenon's memoirs in the LRB archive, and there are links to those on the episode page for this podcast. To subscribe to the LRB and get your first 12 issues for just £12, go to lrb.me/listen. The LRB also now has a daily newsletter, Diverted Traffic, featuring a different piece from the paper's archive every day. A complete absence of references to plague, pandemics or quarantine is guaranteed, and the piece will be brought in front of the paywall for 24 hours, so you can share it with anyone you want to. To sign up to that, go to lrb.me/traffic.